You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In her new book, Everything Conceivable, Liza Monday explains how advances in reproductive technology have made it not only possible but common for women to give birth to children who are not genetically related to them. She also looks at how the widespread use of this technology is altering our understanding of the links between parents and their children, forging new alliances and communities, and changing the traditional definition of family. Her book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Liza Monday to my show now. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Most of us know one or two people who've gone through in vitro fertilization, IVF. But you're telling us here that the use of reproductive technology is producing changes many of us could hardly have imagined. How many IVF babies are born each year in the U.S.?
There are close to 50,000 children born every year from IVF technologies, and there are tens of thousands more born as well from related treatments such as fertility drugs or artificial insemination.
Are most of them born outside of traditional heterosexual two-parent households?
I would say IVF children are mostly born within traditional heterosexual households.
But there are all of the...
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. There's a growing market for what's called collaborative reproduction, where either a heterosexual couple or a single woman or a same-sex couple will reproduce using what's known as gametes from somebody else, either sperm donation from a sperm donor or egg donation. This is an enormously growing niche of fertility medicine, egg donation from a donor.
Do they tend to be among people who know each other, or do they rely on genetic material from strangers?
Genetic material from strangers in this country. There is a booming business. There are many egg brokerages out there and sperm banks as well. In this country, you know, we're very comfortable with online shopping, and there's a lot of online shopping for donor gametes.
So when people are looking for eggs or for sperm, what do? They look for tall, dark, and handsome, PhD.
That is so interesting. There are some sperm banks that offer a more expensive category of sperm donor that would have a professional degree, a law degree, or a medical degree or something. In general, people in this country are always looking for a very healthy donor. People are very health conscious. They're generally looking for a tall donor. They're often looking, if they're within a heterosexual couple or a same-sex relationship, they're often looking to match the person who will be the non-biological parent to create the appearance of biological relationship and to make everybody feel a little bit more like the child fits biologically into the family. But there's definitely a tendency toward, you know, college-educated, high SATs. Sometimes they'll often say, if we're going to dive into the gene pool, let's dive into the deep end.
Well, and they're looking for super babies. We'll get into where that doesn't always happen later. You tell a touching story about a woman named Kendra who was invited to the baptism of triplets who were conceived with eggs she donated, and you attended that ceremony. Could you tell us about it?
Yes, I was very intrigued by this situation. I had actually gotten a call from the mother who was willing to talk about life with triplets, but she also happened to mention that she had conceived using an egg donor, that she always wanted her children to know who that donor was. She felt it was something they were entitled to know, so she made sure to select a donor who was willing to be open, which is somewhat unusual, although certainly possible. This is a young woman who takes a lot of satisfaction in helping people form their families, and she and the two women struck up a quite nice friendship.
And this is rare because there's usually a lot of secrecy in these arrangements.
There's a lot of secrecy. There's a lot of stigma still. Some mothers conceiving with egg donors can feel threatened by the donor, by the fact that she is fertile. They can feel threatened by the fear that somehow their children might view her as the real parent because of her genetic relationship. But this woman was not threatened. She was very grateful.
Well, we've seen cases in the past where surrogate mothers decided they wanted to keep the baby. And so there have been legal precedents where Kendra might very well have said, hey, give me these kids after all.
That's right. Although legally she could not have done that. And I think these situations, you know, can work out actually as often as they can backfire.
What about the triplets? Are multiple births common in these kinds of arrangements?
This is a major part of my book. Multiple births are very, very common in IVF medicine. They are even more common in situations where an egg donor is used because egg donors tend to be robustly fertile. And their eggs, if an IVF doctor transfers two or three embryos into the mother, the intended mother, as she's called, particularly in cases using egg donation, it's quite likely that two or three of the embryos will in fact take.
So yes. They'll be fraternal or twins.
Fraternal twins or triplets, yes.
The use of donated eggs for in vitro fertilization procedures has been growing at 20% a year over the last several years. And is there a reason? Is it because women have been waiting longer to have children?
Yes. I sort of shy away from the idea that women are choosing to wait because there's so many factors why women are giving birth at later ages than our mothers or grandmothers did. But in general, yes, people are starting families at a much later age, which is a huge change in the way that human beings have typically, you know, reproduced.
Well, women will assume that they can get pregnant until menopause, but are they discovering that actually their eggs aren't viable way before that?
Absolutely. And there's enormous variability when women get into their late 30s, and people don't realize this. They'll say, oh, well, my friend conceived at 40. But starting at about 38, there's just enormous variability in whether women can conceive naturally. And if a woman is 40 or 41 or 42, her chances of succeeding at IVF really plummet. And what happens then is the doctor will say, well, hey, we've got an egg donor program. It's not a big deal. You know, she's going to look like you probably. And they treat it as just another step in the medical process. And really, it's more significant than that.
Well, then we have some famous women like Joan London and Elizabeth Edwards having children in their early 50s. And I guess that sends a signal that you can wait long.
Well, that's the irony. The fertility industry has tried from time to time to educate women about declines in fertility, but the parade of women, celebrity women, having children in their late 40s and early 50s, you know, inevitably these are egg donation pregnancies. And other women don't realize that. And often the mothers don't talk about that fact. And so there is a blurring of the message, and there's a lot of confusion out there.
Men are more willing to talk about it. Maybe there's a macho thing involved.
Oh, you think men are more willing
to
talk
about it? Well, you say women are not willing to.
Well, often when a celebrity conceives in her late 40s, she doesn't want to talk about the fact that it was probably an egg donor pregnancy because it's private, yes, but it also, you really sort of don't want to acknowledge that you're in your late 40s if you're a celebrity.
My guest is Liza Mundy. Her book, Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. It's published by Knopf. Well, you say that, we all know that people have been donating sperm for a long time. Sometimes it was under arrangement. Sometimes it was a big surprise to people. But then when did this become a medical thing? How long ago was that?
Well, it's funny. The first case of donor sperm was performed in the late 19th century by a doctor who just wanted to see if it would work. And he had an unconscious female patient on his table for what she thought was a routine medical exam. And
he impregnated her?
Well, she and her husband were suffering from infertility, and it was what's called male factor infertility, which is male factor is as common as female factor. And he wanted to see if artificial insemination would work. So he chose one of his colleagues or med students, nobody quite knows who, and she became pregnant. And she never knew. She never knew that this was what happened. And then after that, for years and years and years, this was a surreptitious practice that would take place in doctors and OBGYN's offices. They would say to a couple having trouble conceiving, well, look, here's a solution. It's not something we really talk about. And they would retrieve sperm from medical students. Often this happened, with a med school nearby or the doctor himself.
But now there's a new technology called intracytoplasmic sperm injection. How does that work?
You know, that has revolutionized the fertility industry, and nobody really talks about this. In the mid-1990s, an embryologist learned that you could actually inject a sperm into an egg. Now, with normal IVF, they're just sort of allowed to drift together in the petri dish. But they learned that you could take a single sperm and inject it into an egg and get a successful pregnancy.
So that's a guarantee. It's not by accident.
It's much more. It has a pretty good success rate, and it meant that men who had very low sperm counts, or whose sperm exhibited what's called low motility, motility. They weren't able to fertilize an egg by themselves, but now they can. And this is a fascinating situation because it means that male infertility has been all but cured if you can afford the procedure.
But aren't some sperm unable to fertilize eggs because they're damaged?
That's right.
And it's nature's way to prevent them from fertilizing eggs.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the evolutionary process tries to ensure that men with, say, genetic problems can't necessarily pass on these problems to their offspring. Some of these sperm they do exhibit genetic problems. Nobody quite knows whether it may be magnified in the offspring of their children, but they do know that male infertility can now be passed on from father to son. If a man is infertile because he has a glitch in his Y chromosome, which is one cause of male infertility, he will pass on that glitch to his son. And doctors joke now that they're creating the next generation of infertility patients, and they are.
Have any studies been done to follow the development of ICSI children?
These boys are still pretty young. They have done studies to confirm that some of the boys do exhibit the Y deletion. And there is a program at the University of California, San Francisco, called Progeny, the program in genetics and infertility. And they are tracking the outcome of the health of these children and the outcome of these pregnancies. As one doctor said, so if the big bad thing happens and something's getting through that wasn't getting through before, we'll at least be looking.
Well, so until now, most of the ethical discussion about reproductive technology is focused on the possibility that genetic testing will lead to the creation of enhanced babies. And now we're talking about perhaps the technology leading to babies with health problems.
That's right. That's right. And I think this receives less discussion because it's kind of sexier to talk about designer babies. And that may be an issue someday. But there are children being born with genetic defects as a result of the technology. And there are studies showing that even IVF children are more likely to be born with low birth weight or be born premature or to exhibit certain health problems. Most of these children are healthy and most of them are wonderful. But there need to be more studies tracking their health and welfare.
What about regulation of this? Is there any regulation of reproductive technology in the United States?
Not really in the United States. There's really not. I mean, our medical system in general is not nearly as regulated as the medical system in socialized countries. The government has stayed out of funding embryo research. It has largely stayed out of funding any research in this area. And it has stayed out of regulation as well.
So they're staying out of it because of the abortion debate?
Well, I think one of the reasons that patients groups have not come forward to demand more government regulation of the industry is there is a real wariness in this country of government involvement in any reproductive issue because it can so easily be politicized.
But we're also talking about a profit-making industry that's grown up around reproductive technology.
That's right. And the doctors don't particularly want to be regulated as well, obviously. And I think in this country, insurance coverage is one way we regulate medicine. Insurance companies have stayed away from covering IVF. If there was more insurance coverage, there would be more oversight and there would be lower prices.
My guest is Liza Mundy, M-U-N-D-Y. Her book, Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. It's published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC, New York Public Radio.
We're back with Liza Mundy, who's a science writer and, in fact, was selected by Oliver Sacks for inclusion in the Best American Science Writing 2003. She's written a book called Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and Children. It's published by Knopf. You've written that you saw an airplane carrying a banner advertising for women willing to donate eggs while you were at a beach in New Jersey.
Yeah, a friend of mine was on the New Jersey shore, and she saw one of those beach banners, you know, advertising for women who would like to donate eggs. You know?
So is that how egg donors are being recruited?
Egg donors are being recruited in every way they can, you know, on campus publications, flyers, planes. Yes, absolutely.
Is there any regulation here? Women and not just eggs, sperm as well, I guess, being purchased from brokers that aren't regulated?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the brokerages who deal with egg donation and procure these donors and then post their photos and stats on websites, they're basically consultants. They're considered consultants, and nobody is really paying attention to the way it's being transacted.
A caller wants to know if egg donors have any problems later on because they donated eggs.
This is something that also has not really been tracked or researched. There is a slight chance with every donation of something called hyperstimulation, ovarian hyperstimulation, which can be a serious medical condition and can land a woman in the emergency room. That's a short-term reaction, but it can be severe. And as far as the long-term health effects of taking the hormonal drugs necessary to stimulate egg production, nobody's quite sure yet.
And when we say donate, are they really donating or are they selling?
Well, of course they're selling. Of course they're selling. I mean, they're being paid anywhere from $3,000 to $50,000, depending on and one of the ironies is gamete donation is one of the few areas in this country where women are paid actually much more than men.
Another caller wants to know whether there are any health risks known for the mother from IVF. Her sister developed breast cancer after her child was born by IVF. Would that just be coincidental?
You know, again, they're not quite certain about this. There haven't been any studies yet showing any sort of link between these drugs and developing cancer later. One doctor I spent time with says that sometimes it might, if there is a propensity to cancer, it might speed it along or make it become evident sooner. But again, this is an area in which there needs to be much more research and more attention paid. And I think that is happening.
We talked earlier about the ideal donors, and you tell a funny story about an online community that's formed about an anonymous sperm donor known as Fairfax Donor 1476.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, you mentioned earlier this innovation in care for male factor infertility, which, and as a result, the number of men contracting with sperm donors plummeted. And if it weren't for single women and lesbian same-sex couples, the sperm donation industry would have gone out of business. But in the past 10 years, there have been many, many, many more women availing themselves of sperm donation. And what happens now is they'll post their donor number online and get in touch with each other so they can know about half-siblings. And there's
we don't have a situation where incest occurs.
That's right. That's one of the reasons. And also, they just think their kids are going to want to know if they're sort of like cousins, you know, hang out together and go to the beach. So there's a group of women who were all attracted to this Fairfax donor, number 1476, and he's a 6'2" blonde financial planner who plays rugby, and they all chose him, you know, separately, but they've got their own web page and they've got their own group now, and people will actually, this is what's so odd, people will actually look at photos of existing children so they'll see how their own children might turn out if they were to use that donor. It's sort of like a Consumer Reports.
This man, I hope he's proud of having fathered so many children.
Well, you know, he knows who he is. He's out there and he knows who he is.
More than 1,000 babies a year are born in the United States to surrogate mothers. Hasn't it been the norm to impregnate surrogates with a gamete that was created with a donated egg so she won't be genetically related to the baby she's carrying because of that case that became so big in
the early 80s. Yes, that was a very high-profile case. And, you know, things have changed so fast. That's now known as traditional surrogacy, when the surrogate is actually impregnated with sperm from the husband and she is both genetically related to the child and carries the child. They're trying to move away from that, and they like to call it now gestational carriers. And they would be impregnated with an embryo using a donor egg. So the surrogate does not have a genetic connection to the child.
To some degree, she's really being an oven here, isn't she?
Yes, you could put it that way.
But
yes.
I would assume she's also charging.
She's
charging. What kind of money do we get for carrying a baby to term, a baby that is not genetically connected to us in any way?
$20,000 to $25,000 in the states that permit surrogacy, and there are some that don't.
Have you heard concerns voiced that in general wealthy men and women will buy surrogacy services and much less wealthy ones will provide them?
Yes, that is a concern. And that's why some women's groups, even women's groups who support reproductive rights and reproductive choice, are troubled by surrogacy because it does involve more affluent couples availing themselves of the service of lower income women. I should say, though, that for women who suffer, say, from uterine malformations and can't carry their own pregnancy, surrogacy can be a situation that works where it genuinely is a woman helping another woman. And as you may be about to point out, I say in my book, it is increasingly becoming a business where a woman is actually helping gay men.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you say that Los Angeles has become the ground zero for technically assisted gay parenting.
That's right. And this is
another... Why L.A.?
I think because there's an agency there called Growing Generations that caters to the gay male surrogacy market, and they have clients fly in from all over the world. I think, you know, there's a lot of money obviously in L.A., and they're doctors who are really pretty much willing to do anything that a patient's willing to pay for.
And we're talking about big money in some cases, aren't we?
For gay men to have children through surrogacy, they're going to pay anywhere between, I'd say, $80,000 and $100,000, all told.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he's not just paying the surrogate.
No, paying an egg donor. And if they're going for an upscale donor, you know, then they may pay the donor $10,000 to $20,000, pay the surrogate $20,000 to $25,000, pay the agency, and pay the doctor.
When you say an upscale donor, in other words, eggs donated by a supermodel with a PhD are going to cost more than eggs donated by the girl next door?
Absolutely, they are, yes. There's a lot of variability, more so than, oddly enough, in the sperm donation industry. It's pretty much a flat fee. Unless you are in that category of a grad student. But with egg donors, there's a lot of variability. It's kind of odd that way.
Is there any counseling involved in any of this?
Very little. And this is how it's so different from adoption. You know, there are similarities between this and adoption, but adoption is a nonprofit process where there's a lot of counseling and a lot of therapy and social service agencies that are all trying to make sure that a child gets a home and gets the right home. But in this case, it's really being treated as a medical procedure. There are some therapy, an hour or so of counseling, but not very much. And there's no support after the fact for parents trying to figure out how to talk to their child about the fact that they are the product of egg or sperm donation.
My guest is Liza Mundy. Her book, Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Getting back to your last point, there are similarities here between what we are talking about and adoption.
Right, there are. Because there is a genetic parent out there somewhere, usually it's an anonymous person, and couples who are conceiving with donor sperm or donor egg really struggle to know how to talk to their child about this, to know when to start talking to the child, because a child has to understand reproduction a little bit in order to understand what's going on.
But there, it seems to me that you're more likely to tell an adopted child who may have memories of something else, or even who just, I guess, will see differences in looks, that child was adopted. But if the child was actually born of the mother, there's no way that the child can know.
That's right. I mean, you can launder. The amazing thing now is that a woman can launder through pregnancy the fact that she's not genetically related to her child. And this is something, I mean, this has never been possible before in the history of humankind. And often parents, in the end, don't tell their child. And there's a very active conversation about this and whether children deserve to be told. Certainly in adoption now, it is widely accepted that a child should know he or she is adopted. And if possible, should know something about the birth mother and the birth parents.
You spoke to a man who's now in his 60s who said he never really understood himself until he met his biological parents.
That's right. There's a group of sperm donor offspring who are adults now who generally found out in their adulthood and felt that knowing that they were the product of donor sperm answered a lot of questions they had always had as children, not feeling that they fit into their family, feeling that they were somehow different from their parents, and feeling that there was a secret in the family that was not being told.
Are there sperm banks and egg whatever you would call them, egg donor
brokerages, yeah.
that actually are willing to release that kind of information?
Increasingly, I mean, I suppose the upside of the commercialization of this is that there's an increasing amount of consumer demand in this country for open donation, and some of the sperm banks are responding. They some of them now have fairly small categories of donors who are willing to be known. And similarly, if you really hunt online for an egg donor, you can probably find somebody who's willing to be known.
But I'm not sure that, getting back to Fairfax Donor 1476, I don't know whether he is all that open to having the doorbell ring and some strange kid say, Daddy.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine in that situation that one man would really want to or be able to have a relationship with 35 offspring.
The United Kingdom has passed a law prohibiting anonymous donations of eggs or sperm. So does that cut down on the whole process there?
It does, and that's a very big deal in that country. The industry is regulated in that country, and a law was passed saying no more anonymous donation. Children do deserve to know the identity of the person who provided it and half their genetic makeup. And as a result, there has been a decline in the number of people willing to donate.
Well, we talked earlier about perhaps some genetic problems. Some could be very dramatic, but some could be dyslexia or other things that can be coped with, but still are inexplicable unless you understand that there was some genetic predisposition.
That's so true.
Or a kid can be yes. autistic.
Yes, yes. And simply to have an ongoing medical history, you know, whenever we go to the doctor and just talk to our doctor, they always want to know how our parents are doing and what they're suffering from or not suffering from. And that's a very important part of medical diagnosis.
One aspect of IVF technology that's of growing concern is the number of frozen embryos in storage. How many are there now in the United States?
I estimate that there are 500,000 now. A count was done about 4 or 5 years ago showing 400,000. And given the number of cycles that have been done since then, there have to be 500,000.
And some of them now have no connection to any people that can be located?
Yes, this is so fascinating to me. There's a whole chapter on frozen embryos because what happens is patients go through this process. They want to have a lot of embryos because then they know that they'll, you know, have plenty of cycles. But when they get to the end and they have excess frozen embryos that they feel they can't bring to term, patients are really paralyzed in knowing what to do with these embryos. And it doesn't matter whether you're pro-choice or pro-life. It's still very hard. People become attached to their embryos, and they don't know what to do. And sometimes they simply just kind of disappear and stop paying storage fees, and the embryos languish.
And eventually are destroyed, although researchers would like them to be used for stem cell research. But that's not going to happen until the end of the Bush administration.
That's right. And in this country, they are not destroyed. Doctors are afraid to destroy them. They don't know what to do with them. I interviewed one doctor in L.A., and he said, I'm never going to be able to sell my practice because I've got all these unclaimed embryos, and nobody's going to want to buy my practice with all these embryos. And what am I going to do? Take the liquid nitrogen storage tanks home with me? Because doctors are afraid that somewhere out there, a couple is going to file a wrongful death suit because frozen embryos were permitted to thaw, and there's going to be some sort of court case saying these are little lives or something like that. That they're very nervous. Nobody really knows what the legal or moral status of these embryos is. And there are now companies that exist to take over embryo storage for clinics and basically assume responsibility for these frozen embryos.
Well, if nobody's claiming them, what will happen with them? Won't they eventually be thrown out? And is that destroying them any more than stem cell research?
Right.
Let's not get
right.
into stem cell research.
As I said, everybody is afraid to throw them out or destroy them because of some sort of legal liability. And so they're just going to accumulate until we figure out what to do. Now, again, in England, the law is that after 5 years, they thaw.
Something that jumped out at me while reading your book was just how much people will endure and how much they will spend to have a baby. Didn't one doctor tell you that fertility patients were willing to do almost anything more than any other kinds of patients, even cancer patients?
Yes, that's what he said. He said they are the most motivated patients I know. It is. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. And some people have a negative reaction to this, and they say, oh, these are just people who are bent on having biological children. And I tend to take a more, I think, empathetic view to that. There are a lot of factors playing into this. But yes, people can be very, very determined, and they can really go through a lot.
It's not even 30 years since the first successful in vitro fertilization took place in 1978 with Louise Brown. Now, this is common practice, and Are new techniques being developed all the time?
New techniques are being developed. There's one called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where a cell can be plucked from a three-day-old embryo, and the genetics can be diagnosed. It can be checked for genetic diseases. And this is something that, some couples are turning to try to eliminate some terrible genetic diseases.
You probably don't know the answer to this, but a caller wants to know if a child born of an egg or sperm donation has any legal right to an estate of their biological parent if the identity was known.
No right. It is considered in this country a legal property transfer, and that they don't have any right to claim an inheritance.
Another caller says his wife is undergoing IVF. It failed the first time. Is there anything he and his wife can do to improve their chances for rounds two or three?
Oh, I wish I could help. You know, another thing about this industry is because it's privatized, the research between clinics really hasn't been shared. It's unlike cancer treatment that way, where there's been a big government push to find, you know, the best way to do the best protocol. Clinics jealously guard their protocols, and it can vary widely. And I'm not a medical expert, and I wish I could help, and I wish the couple luck.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Liza Mundy. Her book, Everything Conceivable, How Assisted Reproduction is Changing Men, Women, and the World. It is published by Knopf.
Thank you so much.